From the Civil War to the Great Depression, a widespread but little-known trend of racial cleansing was occurring throughout southern and not-so-southern counties and towns. The entire African-American population of these communities was forced out through violence or the threat of violence, their land stolen and their homes lost. 100 years later, the descendants of these African-American families live scattered throughout the country, and these communities remain nearly all white. I have with me now award-winning filmmaker Marco Williams, director and producer of the documentary Banished. It's playing at the Film Forum. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
I didn't know this happened. Why do you think these racial cleansings remain so hidden?
Well, I have often said that they are hidden, but the reality is that they're actually buried because, as my documentary reveals, in almost each one of the towns, newspapers actually wrote about these expulsions soon after they happened. So we do have to ask ourselves, why have they remained buried, even though they were part of the public sort of consciousness? My answer, two things. I think amongst African-American families, some shame. It's nothing more shameful than owning something and then being forced to give it up or lose it at the threat of death. It's hard to sort of carry that forth and pass it on down through the generations. I think perhaps equally for the white communities, there is a question of embarrassment. We did this. We don't want to, you know, it's often said of contemporary whites, that happened 100 years ago. That's not me. Don't blame me for it. So I think those are the two sort of contemporary reasons why these histories have remained buried.
Were they part of the racism during the Jim Crow period after the Civil War, these banishments?
Yes, and my film only touches upon that, but actually, of course, the racism that comes during Reconstruction. You mentioned that these happened in the South and border states. So you have African Americans finally able to be full citizens, own land, homestead, be part of a community. And as we know, in terms of Reconstruction, Jim Crow era, that was a threat to many whites, particularly in the South.
And how widespread? You focus on three communities, but can you give us a sense of how widespread this was and which communities were vulnerable to these kinds of expulsions?
The reality is that this was very widespread. However, at this point in time, I can identify 13 documented cases using a very narrow but significant criteria, which is that these communities remain virtually all white to this day. States like Texas, Missouri, Kentucky, Tennessee, Indiana, Georgia. So that gives you some scope. But I know of cases in Wisconsin, Colorado, Maine. The reality for those is that the communities did not remain all white.
Huh. How did you first become aware of these banishings?
I was approached by my co-producing partner, the Center for Investigative Reporting, and they were approached by the journalist who is featured in my film, Elliot Jaspin, who stumbled upon this, as he says in the film. And there was the recognition that there was a film story to tell.
And what about them intrigued you?
I think what I was most intrigued by was, A, the fact that these remained buried. I certainly share the shock, disappointment, outrage that many Americans will feel about this. But I also had an attitude of business as usual. Jim Crow exists. I'm very conscious of that. I think what really compelled me here was the opportunity to investigate mechanisms for redress. What do we do with the atrocities of our history? How might we redress?
You follow the Strickland family, African-Americans who had land in Forsyth County in Georgia 100 years ago. And I understand Forsyth County is a county that had one of the largest, or if not one of, the largest expulsion. How many African-Americans
were driven
away? There
were at least 1,000 African-Americans expelled.
And what portion of the population did they make up?
I would say that was, you know, close to 20-30% of the population. And so I think what we have to appreciate is that, you know, these were rural communities. So it's not New York City, you know, Chicago, but these were African Americans who were part of the fabric of that community.
And how did the Strickland family lose their land?
The Strickland family lost their land as all the African Americans lost their land. And in the case of all of these banishments, there was an allegation of an assault against a white woman by somebody black. And then there was either lynch law, in which an African American was simply lynched, or some judicial judgment that this person was guilty. Here's what I often say. Okay, let's say a white woman was assaulted and even killed, and a black man was the perpetrator. You might say an eye for an eye. But here's the tragedy. It wasn't an eye for an eye. It was an eye for the rest of the body. The entire African-American community was expelled. Threat of, if you, it was essentially, nigger, don't let the sun go down on you in this town. Be out of town by sundown. Mm.
And how did the Strickland family find out about their land 100 years ago?
Well, the way they found out about their land is that the matriarch, Leola Strickland, who when I met her was 93 years old, so she was a child of 4 or 5 when this happened. She always talked about, she didn't remember the expulsion, but she always talked about the family burial ground. For whatever reason, she had retained a memory that there was a family burial ground in Forsyth County. And her grandson always said, well, can't be true because we always knew no blacks lived in Forsyth. But his grandmother persistently said there's a burial ground, so they went and investigated it. And from that point, they then came to an awareness that perhaps there was family land that might have been stolen, or better yet, they really simply asked the question, what became of our family land?
And they did the research.
And they went to the county courthouse, and they were able to discover that one of their ancestors actually owned land, and there was no evidence, no chain of title indicating that that land had been sold. And the journalist Elliot Jaspin did further investigation and discovered that, yes, there's a deed indicating that Morgan Strickland purchased the land, no deed that he ever sold it, but there's evidence that his neighbor obtained the land through adverse possession.
And explain adverse possession.
And adverse possession is a part of American jurisprudence that basically states if you live openly and notoriously on the property for a certain period of time, 7 years, you can then lay claim that you own it. But let's look at the circumstances. African Americans were expelled under threat of death. What would give them the confidence that they could come back? In fact, when they did try to come back, they were threatened again. So the African Americans left. They left fearing for their lives. So, of course, a neighbor could live openly and notoriously on the land. This is the big dilemma, though. The laws really are not a mechanism for remedy because we have something called the statute of limitations.
Right.
So how do we remedy this atrocity or this grievous moment in our history? And I would offer to you that in some measure it has to come through, as somebody says at the end of my film, through a moral imperative. It has to come through the citizens of the county who recognize that something atrocious happened and there's something tangible that can be replaced or restored or compensated.
And there were different moments of moments for reparation that you point out in your film, and we'll highlight those in a second. But I wanted to get to an important point in Forsyth County's history that you link with this Strickland family search for their ancestral farmland. And that was this civil rights march in the county in 1987 on Dr. Martin Luther King Day that was met with angry protests by white residents. We've got some audio from the film.
So it all started very innocently. It seemed as though there wasn't very much like a civil rights march. It was just an outing. As the bus got to the exit, the bus stopped, and we looked.
The Klan was there. The Aryan Nation was there. The White Brotherhood was there. There was actually 7 organizations there.
And again, this is stunning because this is 1987. This isn't, you know, 1963. Explain this march and the connection you saw between it and the Strickland family's exploration of what happened to their family's land.
I think what was really critical for the documentary was to represent and acknowledge that these communities have remained all white for over 100 years, and that in some of them there was the reason for their remaining all white was that there was still virulent racism afoot. So Forsyth County represents that. And this is just speaking film structure. If I put that at the beginning of the film, I don't have to repeat that in other communities. We now understand that white communities have effectively preserved a white enclave. And so this is also important, though, for the Stricklands in the context of their story and Forsyth for the following reasons. They must overcome this recognition that there are people in Forsyth County who do not want them to be there. They must brave, they must have courage to travel from Atlanta up to a county where they know that they could be, in their mind, forcibly expelled. They must enter an all-white courthouse. They must ask white power structure to provide them with the information to help them learn about their people, their land. And so that was really critical. But equally critical is that, as you said, this was 1987. Because we like to think, oh, all that stuff happened hundreds of years ago. This is not the America that I know. And yet it is the America that we know.
A second community that you focus on is Pierce City, Missouri. What happened there?
Pierce City, while not the largest, is one of the more violent ones. And there, the tragedy here, again, same MO, an allegation of an assault against a white woman, a black man ultimately lynched. But here, the white community broke into the United States Armory, took weapons and ammunition, and basically shot into the homes and set fire to the homes of their African-American neighbors who were very integral to this community. I was interested in this story because it began to give shape to some thought about reparation or reconciliation. And in this case, I found two African-American descendants living in St. Louis who, upon realizing that their family had been expelled from Pierce City in 1901, demand of the town, what they discover is that their great-grandfather is buried in the town. And they're so outraged as to what happened to their family that they don't want their great-grandfather to be there. They have a very good rational reason for that. They could not imagine going there on Memorial Day, on his birthday, to lay a wreath in a community that basically said, we don't want you here. So they asked the town to disinter their great-grandfather's remains. And I saw this as an opportunity to at least consider or explore a mechanism for personal reconciliation, personal repair.
And was the city cooperative?
Well, no, of course not. And I mean, I say of course not, and that's maybe not fair, but they were not initially cooperative. They put up every conceivable kind of barrier to the brothers to sort of say, well, you need proof that he was there.
They did bring up some concern that we might be digging up somebody's grave and
right. It's
not your ancestor. Now what do we do?
And I think that there was a kind of validity, and yet the brothers basically were simply prepared to say, let's do a certain amount of digging. If we need to, let's look into DNA. Let's take the appropriate steps, because of course we don't want to participate in disinterring somebody who's not our family member. It's a very poignant moment in the film, I see, because it is a place where black and white, as represented by these two descendants and a county official, do come together. And they come together over a conversation about what happened and the sharing of evidence that this did happen. And it's a newspaper copy from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch that basically says Negroes were kicked out of the community. And it's at that point that the county coroner begins to...
Who is white,
and he turns, and he makes every... He actually helps the brothers achieve their goal, which is to disinter their great-grandfather's remains and help them to rebury him with the other remains of their family members in a adjacent community.
I'm Amy Edding, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC. I'm speaking with Marco Williams. He's the director of the documentary Banished, which is now showing at the Film Forum. He's also going to be doing a Q&A at the Film Forum tonight after the 8 o'clock screening. You have stunning footage of one of the brothers telling this white coroner who has helped the brothers battle the mayor and the cemetery's resistance to this disinterment, telling the coroner he was not going to get his fee right away because the brothers were going to ask the city to assume the costs as reparations. And here's a little bit of audio from that moment.
But, you know, my family feels that the best way to have any sort of healing is for Pierce City to actually make some kind of concession for this, to understand what went on, and that we feel that, you know, we were trying to keep the cost down, but yep. Our thought was for Pierce City to come forth and pick up the tab for all this. There's a letter that was being mailed to the mayor today. And I really felt bad about not telling you beforehand. But, you know, the person to start all this rolling was you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really appreciate that. And I just hope that I don't offend you, you know, and I hope you understand where I'm coming from.
Well, I'm gonna have to get my cost of my casket from someplace.
I understand.
You know, and I know, I'm not I know. Being, I know.
I know, but see, what's going to happen is we'll see what the fallout is, and if things things go down, then, you know, I'm an honorable man. We'll do what,
I'm fully aware of that.
And, you know, we don't have the benefit of seeing this because this is radio, but this coroner is steamed. He is steamed. And what happens? Pure City refuses to pay.
Pure City refuses to pay. In fact, it becomes a game of children's game of telephone. They think that he's asking for $6,000, that he's sort of railroading them. But it, as you said, it's a very poignant moment in the film because it is at that moment that we seem to see black and white coming together despite what happened 100 years ago. And the request for money shifts the paradigm completely. And I pursue this as an active participant in the film, asking the mayor what his thoughts are on this. And he basically says he thinks it's, you know, problematic that the brothers would ask for money for what money can't repair. I often find it quite ironic for those in power, those with money, to tell those without money that money can't repair. But what's most important here is that why didn't Charles bring this up to them in advance?
Right, yeah. Ask
him this in the film, and he later on explains that he didn't trust the community. It's heartbreaking in some sense, but very revelatory. This is how gigantic the chasm is that there's so much mistrust between black and white over something that happened over 100 years ago.
Well, and I want to speak more about that because there's a thread in the reactions of the whites in your film of resistance to what's being asked of them, a monument that talks about the banishments in Harrison, $750 or $6,000, it's disputed, to pay for the moving of the grave of James Cobb in Pierce City, and explaining that resistance by saying nothing we do will ever be enough. Is that true for whites? That nothing, and I'm white, speaking for me, nothing that we do will ever be enough.
I think what we have to consider there is why there's that feeling. It makes me wonder and think about the question then, what did you do so far? Was it that Lincoln freed the slaves and we should be grateful? Was it that the Supreme Court said separate but equal should be no longer, and so now the schools are integrated? In some sense, and I'm a black man, and I can sort of repose the question, what is it that white people think that they have done that, therefore, we've done enough, so nothing that we can do? But I put it this way. Think about this. If you're in a relationship with somebody, friends, parents, siblings, lovers, and you do something that's a transgression, what's one of the best ways to begin to reconcile and resolve that? It's to apologize. And these, in certain communities, the whites are not even able to apologize, not even able to acknowledge what happened. And I think this is what's at the core of the scar and of the wounds, is that they won't heal until we acknowledge that these atrocities happen. And so the request for a monument is in some way simply an acknowledgement. Now, I've traveled through the South making different documentaries in the South. There are monuments to the Civil War, to Confederate soldiers everywhere. Why there cannot be a monument in this regard to the fact that there were African Americans who actually lived in one of these communities and they were very much part of the community. Until both parties are willing to forgive each other, acknowledge and forgive, I'm not sure that anything is going to be able to come of it.
You speak to a psychologist who says that when it comes to racist events like banishments, the black community needs to be allowed to articulate what reparations would make them feel repaired, even if it's an in-your-dreams type of scenario like return my land to me. And whites need to give something that has meaning, something that has helped, is what she said. What does that mean for you?
It really says everything, and that's why I wanted to include her, because it is, in some sense, maybe the white community can only give but so much, but they can give what they can give. We must acknowledge that if you feel that you can give this, I should acknowledge you for that.
And yet there's the we aren't able to talk about Harrison, Arkansas, the county seat of Boone County, but there was an effort there to deal with their racial past. They set up this committee, set up this
A task force.
Yes, and then they also an endowment or a
they
fund,
a scholarship fund
to these two African American girls. You speak with the African American girls and ask them if it's healed them in some way to get this money and this opportunity. And one girl almost rolls her eyes.
Yes, but therein is, I think, but you know, in fairness, if you will, the white community, they made the gesture or the effort that they were capable of making at that moment. We don't ask an infant to stand, to walk before they can stand. Now, I'm not letting the white community off the hook. I think much more is needed, but I think first steps are first steps. So this psychologist's remarks are very key. I think that if we're going to figure out reconciliation, the African-American community must also recognize some aspect of where whites are, and what whites must recognize the needs and the demands of blacks. That's a first step. Then we can parse whether it should be scholarships, monuments, returning land, some greater form of reparations, which a law professor in the film points out, reparations doesn't simply mean a check. It can mean any number of other things. It means to repair.
Any suggestions?
I'm glad you asked.
Okay.
I've been thinking about this. Let's create in cases of banishment where land was stolen, let's create a reparations fund where all Americans, a reparations tax, all Americans put into this fund. Now in a place like Forsyth County, where a white landowner goes to sell her land, an African-American descendant of the blacks who were banished has the first right to purchase. The purchase, however, is at market value. If that African American cannot afford to pay for the land at market value, they can dip into the reparations fund. Now what we've created is, A, the whites who live there now, who may not have been the perpetrators over 100 years ago, get money for their land, the blacks get to return to their community, and we create diverse communities so that we don't have places like Harrison, which is trying to do something right, but flies the Confederate flag outside of their Chamber of Commerce.
I've been speaking with Marco Williams, the director of the documentary Banished, which is now showing at the Film Forum. Again, he's going to be at a Q&A at the Film Forum tonight after the 8 o'clock showing. And you're invited to attend. Marco Williams, it was a really thought-provoking film. It tore me up and tied my stomach in knots, and it was a privilege speaking with you today here on the Leonard Lopate Show here on WNYC. Thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you for having me.